welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. World War II has been on the minds of our DVD gurus as we approach the 70th anniversary of the ending of the war next year. Today we'll talk about some of their favorite World War II films and five directors who were on the scene of nearly every major moment in the war and in every branch of the service. The five: John Ford, George Stevens, John Huston, William Wyler, and Frank Capra. World War II in the movies, that's our topic today. With us once again are Mitch Bryan. He's a screenwriter, UMKC film prof, and writer for 435 Magazine. Mitch, welcome back.
Great to be here.
Jason Heck knows more about the movies and World War II than any 10 thumb drives on the planet. Jason, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Stan too. Ten Hut.
So Mitch, why World War II?
Largely because of this book. A great summer reading, which is Mark Harris's book, Five Came Back, which is the story of those five directors and the effort, the propaganda effort that was launched to move an initially isolationist population towards war. Mm-hmm. And with propaganda films, with on-the-site reporting, which were then shaped into propaganda films, and how it affected these five directors, how they navigated the military system versus the way that they had to navigate the studio system, the way the studio bosses were tapped to provide resources, and then even battles with the production code, because these films were ultimately destined to play before feature films in theaters, and the production code was saying, you can't show that, you can't show that, you can't, that's disturbing. Yeah. You know, so that was also a part of this incredible story.
So, Jason, these are five directors who made great films and did it from firsthand experience based on their own experiences in World War II.
You know, you have these guys are all big personalities, too. And they also so especially people like John Ford, who have a very iconic, you know, the king of the Western, and a guy who wanted to be a part of this and who knew that this was his moment. And he was commander in the Navy, I think was his rank. So you have these guys who are big storytellers, who, against the biggest canvas they've ever seen, World War II, they have immense resources, the U.S. government and the studios saying, you know, please do this. So there's money, there is opportunity, there is assistance from the government that they never would have imagined. And all they have to do is sell the war to the American public. They have to sell heroism. They have to make sure that we know exactly why we're on the right side. So it's some of it's more subtle. Well, not subtle, but think movies like Mrs. Miniver, which tells Americans that the British are plucky and worth supporting, and we need to kind of be on the lookout. This was really kind of before we were involved in the war. And then you have stuff as sort of big and documentary-like as the Battle of Midway, telling what happened at Midway. The fact that they were five of the most talented, greatest filmmakers of all time certainly didn't hurt.
And it's kind of amazing. The all five went into war and all five came back.
And yes, they did. And some of them with shrapnel in them. You know, I mean, these were guys who would leap out of landing craft, who would not just, you know, frame stories from the comfort of a barracks or from an officer's. You know, but Hollywood stepped up. You had Brigadier General James Stewart leading bombing raids over Germany. You had Major Clark Gable as a tail gunner on a B-17. Hermann Göring actually put out a $50,000 reward for the Luftwaffe pilot who would bring down Clark Gable.
Wow.
Clark Gable's discharge papers were signed by Ronald Reagan on his way out of the service. So Hollywood stepped up in a big way. One of the guys we're going to talk about today, John Wayne, felt eternal shame and made a lot of war movies because he was 4-H, because he could not fight in the war. And that was to his great discredit.
Why couldn't John Wayne fight in the war?
He had some health issues. Errol Flynn, the most virile of men, couldn't go to war for things like gonorrhea and flat feet. That was all very hushed up by studio publicity departments. They did not want these guys tinged at all with even a hint of being yellow, even if it was for very good reasons.
But the films we're talking about today, Mitch, Sink the Bismarck, They Were Expendable, Memphis Belle, Saving Private Ryan, these are not films that were in any way considered to be propaganda films.
Not really. They Were Expendable was made during the war, towards the end of the war. So some of these films were part and parcel of the war effort, you know, the propaganda effort. But mostly we just sort of picked six movies that kind of highlight different approaches to telling the story of the war. And what, the one thing we kind of didn't do is we stayed away from the war adventure movies like Where Eagles Dare or The Dirty Dozen, you know, those fictional entertainments, and tried to sort of stay a little bit more historical, a little bit more real.
You know, do war movies appeal to women? The man asked to men.
You know, it's funny. I will say that when I went and saw Saving Private Ryan at Ward Parkway in 1998, there were plenty of women in the theater, young ones, and they were all there to see Matt Damon. So I would say that in a very shallow, for at least one shallow reason, I know they do. But these are movies that are generally, if they have a romance, it's perfunctory. If they have, you know, most of these have one or two women in the cast. Doesn't mean they're not great drama. Certainly they're great drama. I mean, mm-hmm. Lawrence of Arabia didn't have a single speaking role for a woman in the entire cast. It was a great movie. But as to whether they appeal, I don't know. I'm not a woman, but they certainly made a great deal of money.
Danielle Alexander's raising her hand in the booth. She likes war movies. Yeah.
And there's a theory that part of what some of these movies do is they function as the equivalent of the female targeted tearjerker, that these become what I think somebody called male weepers. I think Tom Poe actually said that in a lecture once. And so you get to a movie like The Best Years of Our Lives, which is very much about the trauma associated with returning soldiers. And, you know, I defy any man to watch that movie and not tear up at one point or another, because it's so much about masculinity and the myths of heroism. And these are themes that are examined in the better war movies versus the ones that are jingoistic and they're just rah-rah, you know, Sands of Iwo Jima, let's just go out there and win, you know.
You know, Jason Heck, today is July 18th, 2014. What was happening on this day 70 years ago, July 18th, 1944?
July 18th in 1944, things had taken a very, very bad turn for the Japanese in the Pacific. And this day, Prime Minister Hideki Tojo actually resigned because the U.S. Army had defeated the Marines had defeated the Japanese on the Mariana Island of Saipan. Saipan was considered by the Japanese to be Japanese territory, and it was also a very, very bad omen for the Japanese because it put the Japanese home islands within range of the brand new U.S. plane, the B-29. And it was those planes that, under General Curtis LeMay, would burn Japan to the ground with firebomb raids. He essentially burned out the entire country before the A-bombs were even dropped in 45.
Not so successful, though, in Europe, right? I mean, the tide had not yet turned.
In Europe, we were still bottled up in Normandy. The Germans still had the enclave surrounded, and it was not until a week later that Omar Bradley and Bernard Montgomery launched Operation Cobra, which would finally result in the Allies breaking loose from Normandy and General Patton finally being turned loose to begin his run all the way across France, which would end up stalling at the German border in about 3 months. So Patton would run wild with his Third Army, and they called it the circus, because these guys would go out and they would confiscate every car, every French civilian car. So Patton was he wanted all of his guys mounted on trucks and transportation to keep going fast. So there were civilian cars and hay wagons and tractors and all this other stuff, so Patton could move fast. But that wouldn't be for a week. Right now, at this day in 1944, the Allies were still duking it out with the Germans in hedgerows in close combat.
And Jason Heck will be joining us every day for the next
until May 7th of 2015, actually until September 2nd, until the surrender is signed on the Missouri. I'll be here to give you your This Day in World War II update.
Well, let's start with our list of films today, World War II films, as we talk with our DVD gurus, Mitch Bryan and Jason Heck. Jason, you're up first with a film, Sink the Bismarck. It takes place in May of 1941.
That's right. May of 1941, a dark time for the British. The Germans would invade Russia 1 month later, but it was still looking very grim. The Brits were on the run almost everywhere. Rommel had them on the ropes in Africa. The Brits were not looking good in the Mediterranean. They had just lost Crete with 30,000 men. And then this thing happens. The Germans send their now legendary, but then terrifying, magnificent, enormous modern battleship, the Bismarck, out into the Atlantic to raid Allied convoys. The German fleet was very small. It was not going to stand up in a concerted fleet action to the Brits, but their ships were individually much better than the British ships, and they were much newer. So this movie is about that epic chase that takes place at the end of May. The Bismarck sails. It is intercepted by two British warships, the HMS Hood and HMS Prince of Wales. The Hood is very very famous. It is the largest warship in the world. It is a symbol of Britain, and the Bismarck blows it up within 6 minutes. It blows the ship apart. There are three survivors out of a crew of 1,400, and it is a shockwave. Incredible event that just reverberates around the world, and so it becomes a matter of national pride. Churchill himself says the Navy has no bigger objective than sinking this warship.
And this film was made when?
1959. Okay. It was released in 1960 here in the States by 20th Century Fox. It's Mitch and I just rewatched it. It's a very interesting film. The director, Lewis Gilbert, had made a lot of documentary films for British Gaumont, and so the film has a very documentary feel. Yeah. You sort of go alternate between the confines of the war room, where all of the planning is done, and you're given big picture, sort of a map. You're constantly looking at a map about they're moving these little ships around to try and bring this German ship to bay. And then you go out to these isolated ships in the North Atlantic that have to do the fighting, that have to do the duking out. The models and the models, the ships are portrayed by models, but they're beautiful. They were shot in this huge studio tank. The effects, okay, I get it. In the era of CGI, people who are probably 25 and younger would be, oh, those are silly. But they're not. They're really great. They hold up. The movie sticks very closely to the chronology of actual events. Where it screws up, in my opinion, is in its depiction of the German admiral. He's commanding the Bismarck and a cruiser. And in real life, the admiral, whose name was Gunther Lütjens, was not a Nazi. He had protested Nazi treatment of certain people. He did not much care for Hitler. The movie makes one huge mistake, and it makes him this caricatured, cartoonish, horrible Nazi with a horrible case of self-interest, a huge case of Hitler hero worship. Yeah. And it's a mistake. It doesn't play well. It plays as very fake against these other actors who are sort of very British and very controlled. It's very pretty. It's black and white. It's sharply shot. Lewis Gilbert, who directed it, would later go on to direct three big Bond movies. Directed You Only Live Twice, The Spy Who Loved Me, and Moonraker. Two of the actors in the film who play British officers would later portray men who were James Bond's boss. One who would go on to portray Defense Minister Freddie Gray, and one who would play M.
And who stars in this film?
Kenneth Moore is this British captain who is in charge of maneuvering the ships. He is the director of operations for the Home Fleet. And then Dana Winter plays the stunningly beautiful, I can't begin to tell you how lovely she is, plays his assistant, this sort of British officer named Anne Davis. But it's sharply written, but it's very old-fashioned. It might have been written in 1945 for how hokily it depicts the emotion of the moment.
Why did the makers of this film think that Americans would be interested in a movie that doesn't involve Americans?
Well,
at least not as directly.
It was made all in Britain. They put in a few things for documentary feel. Edward R. Murrow plays himself.
Oh, that's right.
Recreating his famous "This Is London" reports for CBS, and he delivers exposition. He says, "Okay, it's bad that the hood got blown up," and he's really a cool part of the movie. But it was made in Britain. It was only distributed in the U.S. by 20th Century Fox. It did okay. In Britain, it was the seventh biggest movie of the year. I think it made about double its budget in Britain. And then in the U.S., it had a modestly successful release. The Bismarck is sort of a legendary thing because it was this epic ship.
Yes.
The chase to get
this
it was...
This is good versus evil, which is always appealing to everybody.
And the Bismarck comes very close to foxing the British and getting away scot-free after blowing up their greatest warship. So it's very much an epic story. I mean, compared to the Bismarck sister ship, the Tirpitz, which survived another 3 years but sort of skulked in these Norwegian fjords, no one mentions the Tirpitz anymore. But the Bismarck kind of covers itself in legend and drama, and the story plays out that way in the movie.
And what's the clip we have here from Sink the Bismarck?
Well, we have Captain Shepard, who is trying to reinforce the home fleet for the chase, and he is moving ships off of convoy duty and leaving other ships, these convoys, unescorted in his efforts to chase down and sink the Bismarck.
What do you have in mind?
I think we must reinforce the home fleet, sir. We can't expect them to patrol everything from here to Greenland with what they've got now.
Well, where do we get the ships?
We'd have to take ships away from other duty. It would involve some risk. We could take Victorious and Repulse off escort duty. That would give the Commander-in-Chief an aircraft carrier and another battlecruiser.
What convoy were they covering?
A W8SB, sailing from the Clyde tomorrow. It's a large troop convoy, sir. 20,000 men. We'd be exposing them to a long and dangerous voyage without proper escort.
Is that what you're recommending?
Yes, sir.
You're willing to gamble the lives of 20,000 men?
I think there's a difference between a gamble and a calculated risk.
Good for you, Shepard.
Of course, I realize it's not an easy decision to make.
The important ones never are. All right, go ahead and detach those two ships from the convoy. Inform Commander-in-Chief, Home Fleet.
Aye, aye, sir.
That's from Sink the Bismarck. And Mitch, this film for you, what?
I totally agree with Jason that portrayal of the German admiral is so odd, given that the movie was made in 59. There was plenty of reason for them to be able to be more ambivalent about the Germans. So it does feel like a 45 propaganda picture, but it's really cool.
Your picks for favorite World War II films. Our phone lines are open, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. We're talking about great World War II films today with Mitch and Jason. How about They Were Expendable, Mitch Bryan? What about it?
Well, directed by John Ford, it was made in 1945.
It takes place in December of 41, Pearl Harbor, to January of 42.
That's right. And this was a film that Ford made pretty much after he was finished with his duties, making films for the military. And in June of 42, he was covering the Battle of Midway. He shot footage from the rooftop as Japanese Zeros flew in. There's even a moment when a bomb goes off and you can see the camera shake. And you can see all of these films on YouTube. They're wow. They're all available. And, of course, over the years, according to Mark Harris's book, Ford sort of kept saying that he was the only guy with the camera and there was nobody else there. And he sort of built his own image up in terms of his participation. But he did make this extraordinary movie about Midway. And while he was there, gained a real respect for the PT boats. And so he wanted to make this movie about the PT boats that were the small torpedo boats that were able to engage these larger ships. And it's sort of the classic David versus Goliath kind of story, especially considering that when they first came onto the scene, they were ridiculed. Nobody thought they could do any real damage. So he makes this movie in 45 about really one of the darkest periods in the war, the Battle of the Philippines, when it did not look good for the United States. And interestingly enough, by choosing that kind of dark period for a movie that comes out as we're winning the war, audiences suffering from a sort of war fatigue didn't respond to the picture. I think he was very disappointed that it didn't do the kind of business that he wanted it to. John Wayne stars in it along with Robert Montgomery, who was a veteran. And in fact, John Ford gave John Wayne so much grief over the making of this because Wayne had not gone into the service that finally Robert Montgomery came up to John Ford and said, listen, if you don't lay off Wayne, I'm walking off this picture. And so apparently Ford backed down and was a little easier on Wayne. It's a very elegiac, mournful, deliberately paced movie. It also has some really weird John Ford kind of camaraderie moments. Weird because they feel like they're out of a Western versus, a war picture. And so it's a really interesting anomaly. The third act, though, is terrific when John Wayne and company are stranded on an island and have to improvise. And it's a really, really good movie.
What did John Wayne ever say about being picked on by, Mr. Ford?
Well, on every picture. That was Ford's way, right? A little psychological warfare, a little needling.
Yeah.
Needling to what end, Jason?
Well, to drive people to give better performances. I mean, and it's the Duke. If you can't, it makes Ford look real good in front of everybody else if he can take the Duke down a peg or two.
Huh.
Yeah, it's, and yet, Wayne was always pretty... He knew that he owed John Ford a lot in terms of his career, and he even tried to help Ford out when he was making the Alamo by saying Ford could take a camera and shoot second unit stuff. But of course, Ford got on the set and started acting like he was directing the entire picture, and I think Wayne had to tell him to go home. Huh. But I think it's a really interesting movie with a tonality that you don't usually see from films of this period, because everything was pretty rah-rah, and for somebody to take a darker look at the war is pretty impressive.
And the clip we have here from They Were Expendable.
So this is a scene where Robert Montgomery and John Wayne are trying to get supplies for their PT boat and being derided by the person in charge of the supplies.
How about getting some torpedoes from you?
For those cracker boxes of yours? No telling when we'll see a mothership again.
How long have you been on patrol?
The day war started.
What did you get?
Two small freighters, We had hard luck.
Well, while you've been cruising around in the Pacific, those cracker boxes have sunk two converted cruisers, an auxiliary aircraft carrier, a 10,000-ton tanker, a large freighter, a flock of barges, and numerous Sons of Nippon.
And also, in our brief career, we've carried more messages in Western Union.
Oh, I'd like to help you out, fellas, but I got orders.
Snuffy. Who played the leading lady in Tess of the D'Urbervilles in 1932 with the Academy?
And does your crew know about it?
How many do you want?
So they bribe him with the fact that he was in a drag show.
Yes,
question his masculinity. Played Tess of the D'Urbervilles. That would have been a production I would have enjoyed seeing.
It's aggressively John Ford-esque.
Yes.
But it's great. And the PT boat sequences, all this, I believe, was shot in Key Largo or Key West
Key
or something.
Yeah.
They're thrilling because these boats do 45 knots. And when they're leaping around and lobbing torpedoes, it's pretty thrilling with flak and all this other stuff going off around them. They're great. It's really cool.
World War II films is our topic today. Let's go to some phone calls. Let's go to Richard from Leawood. Richard, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
I wanted to mention that my favorite film at the moment, because I just happened to catch it again, is A Bridge Too Far. I've read the books that were written by the same writer, The Longest Day, and then he wrote mm-hmm. A Bridge Too Far. And, of course, it was made into a very well-known movie, which I don't think got as good a review overall. But the thing that stands out in my mind is the last two scenes. One was Sean Connery was the general who led the airborne British airborne troops, and he was basically almost captured because he was caught in a place that he couldn't get out of, and it was in hiding throughout the entire engagement. And when he finally got in touch with headquarters in England, they said, "How are you doing?" He says, "Well, how do you think I'm doing? I came in with 24,000 troops. I'm leaving with two."
Yeah, there were a lot of screw ups involved in that particular movie, and actually in the operation that it depicts, and that's why Mitch picked it as one of his picks.
We're going to talk about it in our second half today, Richard. So hang on, we'll get to it in just a little bit, okay?
Okay. One other comment I wanted to add is when I first came to this country, I had the opportunity to study with a professor in a small college up in Upper Michigan. He was a battalion commander with 82nd Airborne.
Oh, did he jump in Normandy?
Well, here's the funny part. He overheard my conversation about some of these events, about June 6th, and he says, I was part of that, but I never jumped. And the reason was, in one of the training jumps, he broke his ankle.
Oh, oops.
So he ended up being assigned to Eisenhower's staff to follow and do all the early reports. And he realized when all the early casualty reports came in, and there were scenes in the movie The Longest Day, that battalion that was all beat up and they were all hung up on the church towers,
mm-hmm.
His battalion had a 75% casualty rate. He said that was the worst 72 hours of his life.
Wow. Guy was an eyewitness to history, that's for sure.
Yeah. Richard, thanks for the call. Let's grab one more call before a break here. David from Blue Springs, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. I thank you for this beautiful subject. I've traveled the world, and I've been fortunate to see a lot of foreign films, German and Japanese and Russian films. And I was wondering their perspective, your people's perspective on those films. One of my favorite as far as an anti-war film is Stalingrad, Dogs, Do You Want to Live Forever?
Mm. Yeah,
I'll hang up and just give it a lift.
Thanks.
The Japanese don't really much acknowledge participating in the war. Japanese school children are not taught about Japanese atrocities in the war, or if they are, they are taught about sort of how U.S. Trade embargoes and stuff sort of forced the Japanese to act. However, the Russians have made several great films, and certainly the Germans have. Among their greatest, obviously, would be Das Boot. Which is
the submarine film.
Does nothing to glorify what they do. Stalingrad was made, I think, 1989, 1990, and depicts that enormously brutal, horrifying fight.
Good film.
It's a good film. It's an epic film. It's very, very big. But it tells the story of this sort of slow death of this 200,000 German man army as the Soviets trapped them in Stalingrad, and they were reduced to eating horses and rats and finally freezing and dying where they stood. It's a very good film as well.
Okay.
But there aren't a lot of Japanese films about World War II, and if they are, they are very sort of shallow action-type pictures.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with our gurus. We'll get to Memphis Belle, Saving Private Ryan, The Longest Day, and A Bridge Too Far. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. This hour, we're visiting with our DVD gurus, Mitch Bryan and Jason Heck. We're talking about World War II films. And Jason Heck, let's move to Memphis Belle. It takes place in May of 1943.
May of 43, the U.S. Has put the 8th Air Force, as it's known, in Britain to begin the CBO, Combined Bombing Offensive. The U.S. will bomb during the day. The British will bomb at night. And the U.S. has a plane that they think will do the job. It's the B-17 Flying Fortress. And the U.S. says that with the Norden bomb site, which can allegedly drop a bomb into a pickle barrel at 20,000 feet, and 13 machine guns on the plane, they will fight their way to the target against German opposition and get home. That turns out not to be true. It takes the P-51 Mustang, introduced a year later, to get them all the way there and back. But this movie depicts the Memphis Belle, which is the first B-17 to complete 25 missions, and thus its crew earns the right to go home. It plays pretty fast and loose with the facts. These are not the real crew. These are not the real crew of the Memphis Belle. It's produced by William Wyler's daughter, Catherine Wyler. And William Wyler is famous as one of the directors in the book. Mm-hmm. And he also made a documentary called Memphis Belle, The Story of a Flying Fortress. So this is his daughter making a film about the same plane. I'm talking about it because I got to fly in the plane on July 5th. My mom gave me a birthday present. I got to go up to Council Bluffs Airport.
God, I love your mother.
Fly for 40 minutes in a B-17 Flying Fortress, the very same one that played the Memphis Belle in the movie. So I got to sit where Matthew Modine sat, and the seat was still a little warm. It was the greatest day of my life. Mom, I love you. It was the best birthday present ever, and that's why we're talking about the movie, which I just watched with my mom to show her exactly where I sat.
And you enjoyed this film?
I do. It's a very, very, and I cannot overemphasize how old-fashioned this movie is coming in 1990. It is unambiguously, unabashedly heroic. The crew is something right out of 1945. You've got the Italian. You've got the Italian thug. You've got the Irish class president. You've got the goofy ladies man. You've got the bombardier with the perfect lip hugger mustache. And then you've got Matthew Modine, who is the captain, Dennis Dearborn, who is sort of socially inept and a maniacal perfectionist. And then you've got Harry Connick Jr. in the tail gun in his film debut, and yes, he does get to sing. It is a very black and white, us versus them kind of heroism. There is nothing in here that questions the war, but it's also beautifully made, beautifully shot. They rounded up 5 of the 8 flyable B-17s on the planet for this movie and 7 P-51 Mustangs. This was 2 years before digital effects kind of came out with Terminator 2. So everything is kind of old-fashioned special effects. It's process shots and matte paintings and model work. And it really works. Big score. It's a lot of fun to watch.
What's the clip we have?
Our clip here is Captain Dearborn. It is Matthew Modine. It is the night before their 25th mission. The crew is a little nervous. They want to make it through, and he goes out to say good night to the Memphis Belle, to say good night to his plane.
And this clip goes out to your mom.
This clip goes out to you, Mama Bear.
I can't believe it. It's going to be over so soon. Can't imagine going home. Won't be the same, will it?
Good night. And it's nice. He says goodnight to this beautiful plane that will endure unbelievable punishment to get its men home. And the B-17s did. They came back with tails shot off, with chunks of Nazi fighters buried in the fuselage. It was indeed a flying fortress. And the 10 guys on board trusted the plane with their lives, and it gets them home. And it's a really nice movie.
Oh, that's great. We're talking about World War II films with our DVD gurus, Mitch Bryan and Jason Heck, and all kinds of good stuff here. If you have a recommendation for one of your favorite World War II films, tweet us at KCUR up to date. Mitch, let's go to a film that had all kinds of stars in it, Saving Private Ryan. This takes place in June of 1944, and it focuses on D-Day.
One of the two D-Day movies we're gonna talk about, Saving Private Ryan, grossed a whopping $481 million
upon its
release. It's probably the most popular war movie ever made.
It wasn't Spielberg's biggest success, though, was it?
No, but I think that was E.T., but it was a huge success, and it won Spielberg the Best Directing Oscar. It's a movie that is clearly driven by Spielberg's desire to try and get the historical verisimilitude as close as possible in terms of his representation of combat and what it was like to be on those beaches of Normandy.
And I've never had a sense of what a bullet might sound like or feel like until I saw that film. That film puts you right there on the beach.
Yeah, and it's interesting because if you look at the script, the beach landing takes place in about three pages, you know, and Spielberg's idea was to take that and make it a 27-minute set piece. And it's the thing I think everybody remembers that movie for.
Yeah, take a breath before you sit down because you aren't going to breathe for about half an hour.
I mean, in the movie, it's an R-rated, rough, ultra-violent, shocking movie. And I still remember when I saw it coming out of the theater completely shell-shocked and looking out at Ward Parkway and seeing this line of people with little kids, you know, grandpa was bringing his little kid. It was like, I was trying to talk people out of it because it's rough, you know?
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that they decided to do was to try and emulate the Signal Corps photography. The journalists, like the guys in that book, you know, who were on the beach and shooting with small 16-millimeter cameras. And so one of the things that they did is they embraced this really interesting handheld style. They stripped all the coating off of the lenses, so they got these rough-looking flares. They desaturated the colors. It's almost black and white in color, mm-hmm. except the red. And then angled the shutter to create this sort of jarring motion. And it really did revolutionize the way that action films were made after that. And in fact, if you look at some of the other World War II movies that came after that, like Wind Talkers, for example, that movie appears to be terribly old-fashioned because this really redefined the way we see World War II and see World War II movies. Quentin Tarantino said he was influenced by that when he made Inglourious Basterds, which is not an historical movie, obviously. It's an adventure film. But clearly this plot is ripe with ambiguity. You've got this group of this group of soldiers who are sent in to rescue Private Ryan because his three other brothers have all been killed in the war.
And the high command decides they can't let the entire family of brothers be killed.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So here is this question, you know, why are we allocating all this to save one man, and is he worth it, and is it worth it?
Mm-hmm.
And then the film, you know, challenges that when they ultimately do locate him. He didn't want to go home.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to do what he's supposed to do, which is stay there and fight with the guys that are with him.
And it's a great final fight.
It's pretty crazy. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. All kinds of stars in this film, such as
Vin Diesel is in it. Lots of people who started their career, Barry Pepper, Edward Burns, Tom Sizemore as the sergeant, the sort of maternal male.
Yeah.
And it is in some ways kind of a episode of combat after they get on the beach, you know, with one obstacle after another. But the way that they're done, you just realize what an extraordinary director Spielberg is, and he is in his element. He's, I think, of all of his movies, you know, almost more than half, three quarters of the films he's made have some kind of connection to World War II. So he really was leading with his passion. So was Tom Hanks. Everybody was on board to make this movie.
And his passion for World War II comes from where?
Well, his father was a veteran.
Okay.
And so it was that. And, you know, he's a baby boomer, and they are clearly conscious of what the greatest generation you know, did for them.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing about this movie is it is a real tribute to the citizen soldiers. You know, I mean, think about after 9/11, what did George W. Bush say? He said, go out and do stuff, go shopping. You know, it's like, it wasn't about let's all contribute to the war effort. Mm-hmm. Let's all. And I think that's one of the things that is so remarkable about this movie. You know, these are ordinary guys, and it makes you think about all those ordinary guys
who many of whom made the ultimate sacrifice.
The big stars again: Tom Hanks, Matt Damon. Yeah,
right. And so the clip.
Is
they're discussing Barry Pepper, who plays the sniper, is discussing the sense in this mission, whether or not it's the right mission to do. He's griping to Tom Hanks about it.
Sir, I have an opinion on this matter.
Well, by all means, share it with the squad.
Well, from my way of thinking, sir, this entire mission is a serious misallocation of valuable military resources.
Yeah, go on.
Well, it seems to me, sir, that God gave me a special gift, made me a fine instrument of warfare.
Riven, pay attention. Now, this is the way to gripe. Continue, Jackson.
Well, what I mean by that, sir, is you used to put me in this here sniper rifle anywhere up to and including 1 mile of Adolf Hitler with a clear line of sight, sir. Pack your bags, fellas. War's over. Amen.
Oh, that's brilliant, Bumpkin.
Hey, so, Captain, what about you? I mean, you don't gripe at all?
I don't gripe to you, Riven. I'm a captain. There's a chain of command. Gripes go up, not down, always up. You gripe to me, I gripe to my superior officer, so on, so on, so on. I don't gripe to you. I don't gripe in front of you. You should know that as a ranger.
I'm sorry, sir, but let's say you weren't a captain, or maybe I was a major. What would you say then?
Well, in that case, I say this is an excellent mission, sir, with an extremely valuable objective, sir. Worthy of my best efforts, sir. Moreover, I feel heartfelt sorrow for the mother of Private James Ryan. I'm willing to lay down my life and the lives of my men, especially you, Riven, to ease her suffering.
I love Tom Hanks in this film.
Yeah, he's great.
Just loved him.
He's great.
Let's go to some calls, folks recommending, making their picks for great World War II films or with questions. Stephen from Leawood, good morning.
Good morning. The movie The Longest Day has a lot of movie stars in it, of course. But one of my art history professors is actually in the movie. He was an extra. He was studying at the Sorbonne, France at the time. And if you look at that movie, when the men are on the ship before the invasion, there's a guy delivering the mail, and he goes, you know, Jones and Smith, and here's your letter, and et cetera. That's my friend Bob Linehart.
Oh, good for you.
That's a fairly – I know that scene.
That makes it fun.
Well, he was he has a bunch of photos of, like, him holding a – him and a Bob in a German uniform holding a machine gun at John Wayne, and John Wayne holding a machine gun at him.
Well, Stephen, we're going to Longest Day next, so just hang on for us, okay?
Yeah,
thanks. Let's go to Fritz from Leavenworth. Fritz, good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to recommend as one of the great World War II movies and possibly one of the great war movies of all time, Battleground, Van Johnson.
Yeah, with Van Johnson, I believe it was made in, 40...
I'll be off the horn.
49. Yeah, great movie. Absolutely great.
John, thanks for the phone call. I appreciate it. Let's go to John from Shawnee. John, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to talk about one of my favorites, and it's a little bit more on the lighter side, but it's Stalag 17, starring William Holden.
Mitch and I love it, and if you hate Peter Graves, this is your movie. Yeah, it's a terrific film. Holden has enough charisma to power a small city in that movie. He's phenomenal, and it's a really, really good movie.
Yeah, thank.
I always put it on late at night. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, John. Steve's picks for favorite World War II films, Tuskegee Airmen and 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. Scott emailed us this title, Judgment at Nuremberg. Mm-hmm. Charles sent his favorite World War II film, Letters from Iwo Jima, a great film with both perspectives of the war. I would agree with that.
Yeah, certainly better than Flags of Our Fathers. Eastwood kind of made the dual Iwo Jima movies. He made one from the U.S. perspective and one from the Japanese, and the Japanese one is stunning, and the one from the U.S. is sort of, yeah.
Yeah. We're with our DVD film gurus. We're talking about great World War II films. Jason Heck, let's walk to The Longest Day, of course, taking place on D-Day, June 6th, 1944.
Spectacular, spectacular, spectacular.
Yeah.
That's how you would build this movie. It was gigantic in conception, gigantic in star power, gigantic in budget. And it was a sincere attempt to tell essentially every major event that occurred from roughly midnight on the morning of June 6th through midnight on the morning of June 7th. It covers 24 hours, beginning with the Allied airdrops in Normandy of the 82nd and the 101 and the British 6th Airborne, and ends with the beachheads mostly secure and Omaha finally having been opened up, only to cost us both Eddie Albert and Jeffrey Hunter.
This film was made when?
1962. It was based on the book The Longest Day by Cornelius Ryan, who also wrote Bridge Too Far. Daryl F. Zanuck at 20th Century Fox paid $175,000 for the rights and then put $7 million into making this movie. It is the most expensive black and white film until Schindler's List was released in 93.
How did it do with the box office?
Exceptionally well. It made $50 million in 1962, which is real money.
Yeah.
Who's in it? Well, who isn't in it? Let's give you a partial cast list. We've got John Wayne, Kenneth Moore, Richard Todd, Bob Mitchum, Richard Burton, Sean Connery, Henry Fonda, Rod Steiger, Gary Collins, although he doesn't have a speaking role. I wanted to get that in. Peter Lawford, Kurt Jurgens, Robert Wagner. It does not patronize the audience. The Germans all speak German and it's subtitled. The French all speak French and it's subtitled.
Wow.
The Germans are shown reacting intelligently. They are not monsters. These are not black and white goofy portrayals. These are real men trying to do real job, real professionals. You know, the U.S. there's some great set pieces, but the thing about the movie is their attempt to get it all right. So they went and they really filmed at Saint-Mère-Église, at Pegasus Bridge, at Wistrom. And the military advisors for the film were a galaxy of generals and colonels and fighter pilots who'd all really been there and were seeing themselves portrayed on screen. So it's huge. There are some giant set pieces, the assault, the Rangers assaulting up the cliffs at Pointe du Hoc, the Luftwaffe strafing the beaches. It's a really big, well-done, well-made movie that obviously pales next to Private Ryan in terms of its realism. It was made, but you have to remember, this was made 18 years after the landing. So almost everybody who had made it through the war was still alive. And so they were happy to contribute. Some cool notes on the movie. Charlton Heston was actually sought. He wanted to be Colonel Vandervoort, who is the head of this battalion in the 82nd Airborne. John Wayne said, "Nope, I'm going to do it." John Wayne was 55 years old, which was roughly 28 years older than Colonel Benjamin Vandervoort had been when he jumped. But when the Duke says, "I want to be in your picture," in 1962, you say yes. Every cast member who was a major cast member took $25,000. The Duke said, "I want a quarter mil." Because producer Daryl Zanuck had decried poor little John Wayne and given him some grief over his film The Alamo, so the Duke gouged him for 10 times what everybody else was making. It was the last film appearance of Sean Connery before Dr. No, and it features two Bond villains, Goldfinger and Stromberg, in interesting roles in the picture as Germans as well.
What's the clip we got here?
Our clip here is Colonel Vandervoort. He is briefing his men who are going to drop at night on how to use a little toy noisemaker called the Cricket to identify other Allied soldiers in Normandy at night.
"Well, you're as ready as we can make you. This 5-cent toy, it wasn't issued to you for laughs. It may save your life. You're going to be landing in the dark. And on the other side of that hedgerow, a fellow may not be wearing the same uniform you are. So, one click is to be answered by two clicks. And if you don't get that answering click, hit the dirt and open fire. I repeat, one click must be answered by two clicks. Now hang on to this gimmick. It's as important as your weapon. Do you read me?"
"Loud and clear, sir."
"All right. One more thing. Your assignment tonight is strategic. You can't give the enemy a break. Send him to hell." "That is all."
That's the Duke. That's from The Longest Day. Two quick emails here. Mark writes us to suggest Midnight Clear, saying, describing it as a beautiful anti-war film, World War II, just the opposite type of film you've been discussing, yet still very powerful. Another Mark sent us this memory that shows the power of film. He writes, "I saw Saving Private Ryan with my dad, who was a World War II vet from start to finish. The ending of the movie was one of the few times I saw my dad cry. Then he looked at me and said, 'The real war wasn't that loud.' after that, we saw the movie. After we saw the movie, he started telling stories from his experiences, something he had never done. Hmm. Some were funny, some were horrible, but all were treasured by his kids and grandkids. Huh. Great memory, Mark. I'm really glad you sent that one in. Mitch Bryan, you hold the keys to our last film today, A Bridge Too Far. This is from September of 44, about 3 or 4 months after D-Day.
That's right. The picture was made in 1977. Richard Attenborough directed it. They decided they'd take a page out of Daryl Zanuck's book and populate this movie with an all-star cast, just like The Longest Day. So it was a cast including Dirk Bogarde, Ryan O'Neill, James Caan, Michael Caine, Sean Connery, Edward Fox, Elliot Gould, Anthony Hopkins, Gene Hackman, Hardy Krueger, Laurence Olivier, Robert Redford, Maximilian Schell, and Liv Ullmann.
What a fun set that would have been to
huge,
be on.
Huge cast. They spent $25 million, which was big money in 77. It only made 50, so it barely broke even. Mm-hmm. And it was called, you know, by many, a movie too long was what some of the critics, because they just couldn't resist going for a cheap shot.
Yeah.
It's actually a pretty good movie. It tells the story of the disastrous Operation Market Garden, which was an attempt to seize a series of bridges in the Netherlands. And then hopefully be able to attack Germany. It did not work out well. It was a real disaster. And it's all about sort of the overreaching ego, frankly, of the British officers who concocted this little operation.
Of General Bernard Montgomery and General Frederick Boy Browning, who discount intelligence about very powerful German units being in the area.
Constantly telling everybody, this is how it's going to be and this is how it's going to work out. And just every time, you know, I don't think so. And there are lots of surprises in terms of how badly things go wrong. It's, again, not like – it's kind of old-fashioned in the sense that it's not very bloody. There's a certain restraint that Attenborough brings to it. But, you know, upon rewatching it recently, I think it's a much better film than everybody gave it credit for.
Well, Connery's performance is amazing. He's great. He's really good as General Urquhart, who watches his division get destroyed all around him in place.
Yeah. And in fact, that's the clip. This is the early briefing when they were telling Connery's character how easy it's going to be to drop in behind enemy lines.
This is from A Bridge Too Far.
I need drop zones as close as possible to the bridge. Now, clearly, this area is no use at all. Kind of my chaps landing on the top of chimneys, but... Now, this looks inviting here. What's the terrain like?
Sorry, sir. All our reports indicate that this terrain here is too soft for glider landings. You see, the nose digs in first on touchdown, the whole thing goes arse over tip, total write-off.
All right. What about there?
No, afraid not, sir. You see, after the drop, when we bank for our return, we run into a whole lot of flak and rubbish in this Jerry airfield up here at Deal.
Presumably you're intending to let us land somewhere.
Oh, yes, hopefully, sir. But as I was saying, we cannot afford to lose a single aircraft. That is the problem.
My problem is I don't just need drop zones. I need drop zones I can hold and defend. The rest of my division arrives with a second drop. And General Sosabowski's Polish brigade for the third.
I understand, sir. But we really think we found the right place.
Yeah, sure they did.
It wasn't the right place at all.
Mitch Bryan, Jason Heck, what a great addition of our DVD gurus, World War II films. Thank you both for coming in. So good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.